Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is March 1st, 2018, and I'm your host, James Jones. Joining me today is Guillaume Veillette.
Always prepared.
It's your motto.
Mm-hmm.
Also joining me today, Mr. Greg Leahy.
Hoi hoi, everyone.
Good to see you, Greg. Hear you, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I've been accused by listeners of covering up for the fact that you don't have corporeal form, so.
Yeah, well, you know.
Maybe it would be.
It's just you know, trying to deflect away from that by saying it openly is not going to work.
Well, we can try. We can try. Like, maybe it won't work, but we sure can try. But this is episode 561. John Lindemann will be with us later. He is stuck dealing with some work things. And so we're going to go ahead and just soldier on without him. But first, before we kick into new business, I wanted to give a quick promotion. If you are not a frequent visitor of Nintendo World Report, this week is what they have been referring to as Xeno Week, which is a week-long celebration of all things Xenobladian. So that has included a reposting of this show's Xenoblade Chronicles X podcast, which I listened to front to back and was kind of baffled by how much detail we got into in plot discussions. But also the posting of the very first episode of the quote, The Thirsty Mage, which is a new connectivity segment specifically about Xenoblade 2. That's a 3-hour long podcast with Greg and myself, as well as the host of that segment, Mr. David Lloyd, and the host of Talk, or one of the hosts of Talk Nintendo, Casey Gibson, diving into Xenoblade 2. And since it doesn't look like we're going to do a Xenoblade 2 retrospective on this show, there you go. It serves the exact same purpose. And like I said, it's 3 hours long. It's 3 hours. It's a long podcast. You can go enjoy that. But first, well, that's second now. Second, new business. Third? Second, new business. Guillaume, why don't you start us off?
So I've reviewed a game for Nintendo World Report. Yeah.
I did. Carly did. What fucking year is this? Yeah. John runs the website? What year is this, Guillaume?
It's really, really weird. I don't think it ever happened while I was on, you know, on this website. So, yeah, like I've reviewed games before, but there was never kind of a need for like all hands on deck. You know, everyone needs to pick a game and review it. And actually, we're running out of staffers and Neil's outsourcing reviews.
I was tempted to tell John, but he's not here, to pick a game so he cannot turn his review in. But unfortunately, he's not here, so I can't do that.
Yeah, well, at least he. Yeah, he's already ahead of you, not turning in anything. So
he's not turning in himself.
So I've reviewed the Subsurface Circular, which is a Bethel. I don't know how to pronounce his name. Bethel Short. So the creator of Thomas Was Alone, which was kind of an indie mega hit that we've talked about on this show, and I've talked about it personally, positively, mostly. It was this very kind of minimalist looking platformer that also had kind of this unusually deep story that it was telling, and you know, it had good narration, and it was just it was kind of surprising. It was not something that you expect from a platformer that stars squares and rectangles and, you know, other quadrilaterals. So this time, like, he's released a few games since then, but nothing on Nintendo consoles. And now Subsurface Circular came out last year on PC and on iPad, and now it's on the Switch. And it's the only console so far, I think, that got a release of this game. And it seems like Mike Bethel decided to play to his strengths. And so mostly this is a narrative game. And it's all about the story. And when I say it's all about the story, I really mean it, because there is very little in this game outside of writing. You are reading dialogue and you're picking dialogue options from a dialogue tree. And that's basically all the game is. It takes about like maybe 2 to 4 hours to get through. And in that time, there's maybe kind of like maybe three actual puzzles to solve. So it's kind of a visual novel, but maybe a little bit less involved than that, like more of a Twine game, which is a game that basically, like, it's this game engine that anyone can use to create an interactive story. And you know, some people might have played something in a browser without knowing they were playing a Twine game. A popular example is the uncle who works at Nintendo. If you have never played that, look it up and check it out. It's good. But yeah, Subsurface Circular is one of those, but it goes a little bit further in that it gives you polygonal graphics and a pretty good soundtrack, and so it's not just, it's not literally just text on the screen. You're still seeing something. But the plot of the game has you play, like, it's in the near future in an undetermined city, and you're playing as a robot, a sentient robot. You're a detective. And conveniently enough, you're geo-locked to the subway. So actually, you never move from your train. You never move from where you're sitting. And the game starts, and this other robot, a construction worker, an overseer, basically asks you, he's like, hey, you're a detective, right? I've got a case for you. And you're like, well, I can't take my cases from humans, from the management with capital M. And but the, you know, the other robot insists, and like, oh, I've, you know, my, one of my friends disappeared, and I'd like you to look into it. And basically, you have no choice to take that on; otherwise, you would have no game. Basically, like, there's a rotating cast of robots coming in and going, and you never move again. But you just basically talk to whoever is happens to be sitting in front of you, and so you know, try to ask them about, like, oh, have you heard about any disappearances, any strange goings on? Eventually you might unlock a focus point, which is basically kind of a clue or a, you know, a topic that you can then carry with you. You can use that new topic, and ask another robot about it. And so that's how you progress through the story, basically. You know, you're going to talk to the nanny robot, and, you know, she might talk to you about the what's going on politically on top, on the ground. And she might mention something about a, you know, kind of a reactionary party that is against the robots. And so, okay, so you can take that info and then ask the priest robot, because yes, even priests have been replaced by robots, and you can ask him about this political faction and about all sorts of other things. The gameplay is very linear. Like, you can't really, there are maybe three puzzles. One of them is like might require you to build a logic grid to solve. It gets pretty complicated if you don't have a pen and paper at the very least. But it's still solvable. And if you can't, like, there are hints, you can ask for hints. But otherwise, you can't really fail. You can't really get stuck. Basically, you can just exhaust every possible dialogue option, and eventually the chapter is going to end with all the info that you need to progress, and then the next chapter will start, and you'll meet the same cast of characters that you would have if you had answered anything else. So I played through the game twice, and I could barely see any difference no matter what I picked. Usually, like, there's as many as, you know, four or five dialogue options, and you can be just, like, very helpful, very polite. You can present yourself as a detective, or you can hold that information back. You can be like, hey, like, can't you read social cues and see that you're, you know, bothering me, even though you're the ones usually who approaches them? So it's not an answer that really makes sense, but anyway, like, it's kind of the rude answer that you can pick if you want. And I find that the robots barely react when you're being rude. And I find that to be kind of a problem, because then it becomes more of a, you're kind of just role-playing, but no one around you is or cares. they're going to answer the same thing no matter what. So what is the point? It's weird. And also, my main problem and something that I wanted to... In my review, like I kind of described the game pretty quickly because I wanted to get to the kind of the main problem I have with this game as quickly as I could in the review. And it's that these robots, really, they're stand-ins. And it's not subtle. They're stand-ins for immigrants. It's not a perfect analogy. And in fact, you can unlock a commentary kind of a feature, a developer commentary feature, when you finish the game. And the developer admits, like, it's not a perfect analogy. It's not, you know, the allegory is kind of, it's not ideal. It's loose. But I would say that it's more than loose. Like, it doesn't work. And it's kind of gross when you... I don't know, when you read it as the allegory that it very clearly is. And the one thing that I got really stuck on is this dialogue option where basically you're just asking, like, you're expressing disbelief that the humans would ever be resentful because you took their jobs. And the whole conversation really doesn't make a lick of sense. Because someone will tell you that, okay, get this. So this, I think it's the priest who's like, you're asking him why don't the humans like us? And he says, they think we're foreign invaders. I've heard them use that word, invaders. We take jobs that historically belong to them. We require upkeep and expensive infrastructure, like this train we're currently riding. And it's like, okay, like if you can't read between the lines here, like clearly... invaders taking jobs, it's clear what's actually being discussed. And your dialogue options is, oh, but we add so much to their economy, or we do the jobs they won't. And keep in mind that the jobs they won't here presumably refers to like priests, psychologists, athletes.
Yeah,
so athletes, pro athletes have been replaced by robots.
I feel like the analogy would have worked better if they embraced also rolling in... I mean, I understand that there was a message they were trying to convey, but it probably would have worked better if they also rolled in the fear of being replaced through automation and just kind of went with that as the theme in general.
That's the thing. So I don't really talk about that in the review because I ultimately find this particular point more important, the immigrant allegory, which I find... You know, like if you're trying to humanize, you know, an oppressed people, maybe it's not such a good idea to replace them with robots in your story. And the automation thing does come up. It is one of the themes. But the game so completely, you don't see any humans ever in this game. And the game doesn't seem to be all that concerned with what's happening with them. You know, like there are hints that you can glean from your conversations, like, clearly, like, this is still a capitalist society. They do mention that, you know, only the rich can use certain robots' services. So, they do kind of outline some sort of world where their automation is, like, even more rampant than it is right now. It's very clear, it's very obvious why there would be discontent in that case. It doesn't make sense first that your character is so completely stupid as to not understand why people would be upset that, you know, they're poor and can't do any jobs. And second, like, you so don't get to really see the details of their society that it kind of feels like it's really secondary, you know, like the game doesn't seem to care all that much about the...
It's taking a humanizing and essentially trying to rebut the argument of a people it won't show, I guess. And as a consequence, it doesn't actually present... It creates a cutout of the other position that doesn't actually give it the opportunity to be seen. Like, because if you were to go and they show you, like, oh, things are really fucked for most humans, well, then they might be more sympathetic in that case. Like, oh.
Yeah, well that's the thing. I don't know. You don't get really the human perspective. But in some other conversations, you can kind of take some sort of the side of humans, but never seems to correspond to anything that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like you're missing some pretty important context.
Yeah, and it feels like when you're playing the robot, playing devil's advocate for the humans, it feels like straw men. And that's kind of weird, because you would think that a human who wrote this would have thought more about the human consequences to...
Well, keep in mind, that human who wrote this may have never lived on the other side of the allegory he's trying to create.
Yeah, that's the thing. Mike Bethel is, as far as I know, like a white British man, just...
He didn't grow up in like a Rust Belt town.
No, like, no. And probably, you know, this is somewhat like his answer to some of the more, you know, reactionary political groups that have appeared in Britain. But
right.
I don't know, like it seems so half-baked, and the game was made in 4 months, and I think that's part of the problem. Maybe he needed an editor to do like a very deep reading of what he wrote first of the script before. I don't know, but what he put out there is just insufficient. And so, yeah, the automation thing is not really explored all that well. And even at some point, he almost makes a parallel between the robots and slavery, talking about them like they've been freed, but only to work for the government. So again, like it's not a perfect allegory, but I'm so glad that he didn't try to push more than that, the slavery angle, because again, I think he would have been out of his depth.
It almost would have been interesting to see how far off it ends up.
Yeah,
like almost as an academic level, like how hard is he going to steer into the iceberg?
The thing is, like I liked it enough as I was playing. But it was nothing that blew my mind. I grew up reading science fiction. I've read Asimov. He references Asimov's three laws here. I think he should have gone ahead and kind of reminded us all what those three laws actually are, because the last pop culture reminder we had of them was I, Robot with Will Smith. So, again,
you mean cultural touchstone we
cultural,
had.
Yeah.
Please.
But, you know, like there are these times, like you would think that a game that is entirely dialogue choices would give you the opportunity to drill down into and learn more about the issues that he wants to touch. But every time that I try to get at a question, the game only, you know, barely touched it and kind of refused to go too deep into anything that it brought up.
It sounds like a bit of a sketch of a world rather than a fully built one, which is not surprising if you're going very heavily allegorical, because of course the world is this one, not the fictional one. So I could kind of see how they wouldn't build it out as fully as might be more satisfying for an actual game experience.
But that might make you look like you're tilting at windmills, like you're. Mm. I mean, and to some extent, it sounds like what Guillaume's describing, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like there's a little bit of straw manning going on here, where it's like, this is the position I'm putting up, and then you talk your way through it.
Yeah, like it's, I don't think this game would convince anyone who hates immigrants, for sure. I don't think they would be playing this game, but also...
I don't know if xenophobia is your target audience here, but maybe people who feel put out by, not necessarily xenophobes,
yeah,
people who feel disaffected and look at things like automation and immigrants as depressing wages and stuff like that. It's not necessarily like a man, fuck all foreigners thing. It might just be like everyone's out to make, to drive down wages as hard as they can.
Right. And so that's kind of like deep in the game. They get to that a little bit, but then again, like they don't go deep enough, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And there's also kind of an attempt, half-hearted attempt to humanize the robots. Like we do know that, well, they claim to be sentient. They've got their fucking like Descartes, I process, therefore I am.
Fucking kill them all. Burn them all
actually,
down.
One character actually says that. But they're shown to have emotions. In fact, that's like one of the puzzles. You have to actually kind of change the emotions of someone you're talking to. But these characters don't have any inner lives, you know, like they're whatever temperament or personality that they have is actually tuned to the kind of job that they have. So these immigrants, these robots, are entirely their job. And, you know, it's just funny that the arguments that you have in favor of immigrants, I mean robots, is like, but we add so much to the economy. And there's nothing that considers, like, their personhood. And then towards the end of the game, there's a kind of like an ethical decision that requires you to see them as people. And I failed that test. I did not see them as people. I was like, well, if I'm going to be hurting, you know, either humans or robots, I'm going to hurt the robots because they haven't shown themselves to actually be any kind of like convincing simulacra of humanity. Anyway, like... So, like, in my review, I actually mentioned, like, maybe I'm thinking a little bit too deeply about this. But, you know, like, the allegory is flagrant. And the developer specific in the commentary says, like, oh, some people want, like, apolitical games, and I find that ridiculous. And I aim to make a game, you know, absolutely political. So, I you know, I think it's better to engage with that and try to actually criticize what it's actually saying and, you know, its politics. It's funny because I'm very much the outlier in my review. A lot of people seem to be just, you know, happy to have read a cool story about robots. But the thing is, like, the more I thought about it, the more angry I was. What it was actually saying. So I almost gave it a 4, but then I saw what the site gave 4s to, so I gave it a 5. But that's as high as I'm willing to go.
Your review score is your review score, Guillaume.
Yeah, well, you know.
I've given 4s to some games and then wish I'd gone back and gone lower.
Yeah.
Looking at you, Ace of Seafood.
I guess very quickly, I finished Etrian Odyssey 5. It was very good. It's another Etrian Odyssey game. There's so many, you know, so many podcasts that you could be listening to that have me explaining exactly what an Etrian Odyssey game is and what I find good about them. But it's another good one, you know, and I really enjoyed it. And it got easier and easier as I played, because it turns out to beat the first boss, I did bump down the difficulty. And doing that means you get 20% more experience per battle. And that kind of completely screwed up the difficulty curve. And I just became more and more overpowered as I went. The thing is, though, I really didn't mind. It took me like 65 hours to get through. And I had a great time every time I was playing. It made my commute go really, really fast. Just the act of mapping dungeons and figuring out the puzzles. To get around the FOEs, which are these giant creatures that, you know, are way too powerful for your party to tackle on head on at first. So at first you always have to go around them, and they move when you move, and it's always like a head scratcher trying to escape them. And so all of that was like very, very satisfying, and I don't really care if I did not hit my head against a brick wall every time I was fighting, you know, any kind of new enemy. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. And when you beat the game, you unlock like a sixth strata.
Yeah.
And I'm still playing, but, you know, I'm mostly done with the game and I'm ready to move on. But it's a really good one. And I've been recommending newcomers to start with 4 instead of 5 because it has more difficulty options. It is kind of more welcoming overall. But 5 turns out, when you bump down the difficulty, is still accessible. And it's also very cheap right now. I don't think it's been selling well at all. So you can get good deals on it. So I recommend that if you haven't abandoned your 3DS a long time ago, like, this is a good purchase.
Cool. You looking forward to Persona 2 or Q2 now? I don't know if there's any others on the horizon.
Yeah, I don't think so, but I do have Untold 2, which I hadn't played, so I bought that a while ago, and I also have Etrian Mystery Dungeon.
Oh, God.
And I think they're doing a sequel to Mystery Dungeon, right?
They are, but I'm going to play through the first one first. And
I mean, has John taught you nothing?
Well, and the thing is, I'm pretty sure it's going to be better than... what is it, Pokemon Mystery Dungeon or whatever?
I mean, that's not a high bar to get over.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we'll see. I did not pay a whole lot for it, from what I remember. So
fair enough. All right, so I'm going to go because mine's going to be really, really quick. So I am playing, or have been primarily playing, well, like I said back, I beat Dragon Quest Builders. It's good. I enjoyed it. I was ready for it to end when it ended. And then about 10 hours later, I was like, yep, I'm completely finished with this game. About 55 hours. Not bad. It's a fun game. It does maybe stay a little too long. But if you're really into that kind of thing, then like you can go nuts. But mostly I've been playing Fear Effect Sedna, which is coming out on the Switch on like Monday, I think. Mm-hmm. The problem is all impressions are embargoed until Monday, so I cannot talk about it here. And I mean, you could argue whether or not I should even mention I'm playing it. Switch tells everybody I'm playing it, so it's a moot point.
Everybody?
Well, everybody who I'm friends with, which is a decent number of show's listeners, so like whatever.
It's okay.
I mean, it's impressions are embargoed. Facts are not. My review should be up on Monday or soon thereabout. You should read it. So I'm moving on. I did play about 40 minutes of the Alliance Alive demo, which is now out on the eShop. And I don't really have a lot to say about it. It very clearly is another Furyu 3DS game. It doesn't have the smallish spaces of... God, I want to call it the Seventh Saga so bad.
The Legend of Legacy.
Yeah, yes. You just got to think of alliterations. That apparently is the name.
Their thing, yeah.
Yeah. And it's much more open than that because it's a big world with cities and stuff you can run around in. But it still has the same kind of visual style. The combat seems pretty simple so far, but it does seem like progressing isn't based on level up. It's based on what you do. So one character got hit a bunch of times in a fight. The other one used a bunch of magic. And the one that got hit a bunch of times had their HP go up. And the one that used magic had their MP go up. Using skills unlocks related skills. So there's a bit of that. But overall, you know, I've only played a little bit of it, so I don't have a whole heck of a lot to say. It seems good so far. Looks like I'm right about to hit the boss fight that's tied to this demo, but you know, we'll see. I already have this game kind of pre-ordered, but of course I could back out, but you know, I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, so you had played Legend of Legacy like through the whole thing, right?
Yeah, I beat Legend of Legacy.
Yeah,
it's supposed to be better than that,
right? That's what I've heard, and I enjoyed Legend of Legacy enough, not enough to play through it 8 times like you're supposed to with each, you know, character. But...
Oh, fuck that. No. I played it once, and that was enough.
Yeah.
Because playing through it 8 times would take forever.
So are there characters that are kind of the equivalent of, I don't remember the name, but there was a frog that you could play as.
So this world has an entire, like, humans and then also monsters, so I'm gonna assume we're gonna see a lot of animals, a lot of animal people. In fact, I had a run-in with some dog people who were very rude, and the game didn't let me bash their heads in, which I was upset about, but I'm sure later I'll have plenty of opportunities to kick monster people in the face. But yeah, it seems nice, and I'm enjoying the character interaction a little bit. So you know, we'll see where it goes. So I'll have real impressions for that maybe next week after I've got through the demo or after the game comes out. Greg,
Yes. So I too have been playing a demo. As far as I could tell, this is not one that's been released outside of Europe yet for whatever reason, but this is the Kirby Star Allies demo. Yeah, obviously been plenty of coverage of the game as well, hands-on, yeah, kind of impressions have been going up because it's a couple of weeks away now. It's pretty soon. I've thoroughly enjoyed the more recent kind of traditional side-scrolling Kirby games on 3DS especially, and going back to the Wii game Return to Dream Land if you're in America, or Kirby's Adventure Wii if you're in Europe. And that's the thing, this I guess is obviously the first thing you're going to think of is it being more of a kind of tilt back to that game because of the multiplayer angle that the console experience kind of lends itself to. And I didn't have a chance to play the demo in multiplayer, so it's kind of limited in that way. It certainly seems to be a big part of the appeal, but
Karen thankfully has her dual citizenship. She has a UK passport and everything, so I am morally right to go and change her account to the UK, and so I was able to download the demo. But obviously, no one else who's not in my situation could do that, of course.
I think morally, you're not even allowed to play that demo. I think you can only watch her play it.
Okay, yeah. Fine. But so I played, but only two players, and it's kind of a bummer that you have to have the CPU companions with you. You have to have a four. Well, I guess you don't have to. I guess I could have decided not to create three other, companion characters.
Yeah, I mean, there's occasional what would seem to be kind of gating mechanisms going on in terms of like, okay, here's a part of the level where there's four levers to be pulled to bring a part of the environment down, and there you would have to have the full complement of people on your side. And mm-hmm. If in terms of you kind of getting CPU people, you press X and a heart appears and you sort of launch it at an enemy and then he comes to your side.
Yeah, it feels weird. Like, why not do that to every enemy then? Like, Kirby doesn't have to kill, but he does.
He never had to, really. I mean, Kirby's sort of relationship with killing everything's always been a bit weird. I mean, he is... he can float. He's very difficult to kill. Like he's always been a bit of a. It's always been a bit of a stretch to say it was strictly self defense. That's for sure.
Yeah, especially when he's commandeering a giant robot, like Planet Robobot. I don't know. It's weird because you're going to need the powers to solve a lot of the puzzles, of course. That's kind of standard in Kirby. But I feel that even more than other Kirby games, this game will respawn enemies as soon... Like, it's a freaking Ninja Gaiden on NES game, almost.
Yeah, you scroll them... If you kill an enemy by accident that you would have liked to get a flame power-up, so you can light a fuse... To blow something up to open up a passage, just scroll off and just scroll back on again, and he will have reappeared.
They're right there, and even though they're following you in your posse of the Kirby posse, it's weird. Have you toyed with the combination of powers?
Yeah, so what you could do is kind of, I think it was. X again, where you could kind of stop in place and combine power. So for instance, say if you've got Kirby with a sword, now he can hold the sword aloft and it's sort of beckoning his allies to imbue the sword with their power. So if you had a flame guy in your party kind of thing, he could breathe fire onto the sword, it become a fire sword, which in general it just is, it does more damage, it's more deadly, but then also some of these puzzle elements, like I said, with the fuses now, or you could just light it by swinging the fire sword at the fuse. That would do the job. Or certain enemies might walk around with like wooden armor on, wooden shields. You can just slash right through those because they burn straight away. That kind of stuff. And, you know, there's other, you know, you've got water, you've ice, you know, so you've got these kind of... The ones which are more physical in nature, you know, Kirby's using a sword or a yo-yo or turning into a stone. And then you've got the sort of elemental ones, you know, electric, water, ice, fire. You know, and those seem to be the main kinds of combinations that you're seeing so far. I mean, clearly there's a lot of powers that are going to be in the game. You know, you've some of the ones that have been shown that are less sort of common, you know, like painting little DDD characters onto the screen that kill stuff, and spider and all. Like, it'll be interesting to see how some of those more kind of unusual powers get could be combined, but that this is sort of the gist of it so far.
Yeah, it turned into a curling stone by combining stone and ice, so
yeah.
It's good. That was pretty cool.
I like that.
The game seems a little bit sparse visually to me. Like, there's a lot of personality for sure, and like the enemies and Kirby are all very well animated. But I find it weird that the frame rate seems to be only 30 per second.
It's definitely not 60, is it? I mean, you could tell that much. I assume it's something in the 30-ish kind of range. I mean, Kirby games generally don't require, you know, a level of precision where I feel like it's going to be problematic as a practical matter or anything like that in terms of responsiveness. But, you know, with the, like you said, the animations and how lively things are, it does kind of show up a little bit. But I think for me, it's probably just one of those things that once you kind of get locked in and used to it, as long as it doesn't actually vary, it won't be an issue.
Yeah, I just found it a little bit sometimes, you know, anything that would improve the how easy it is to read the screen, I would appreciate, because it does get busy. You know, you've got Kirby.
Number of characters, it's a fair point. And then, you know, a bunch of, powers sort of going off.
Right, yeah. So you never know exactly. Oh, yeah, you can lose track of your character a little bit easily, I find. But it's a Kirby game, so it's more of a... You know, it's not a deadly setback. It's more of an annoyance.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, you got two levels in the demo. You've got the kind of traditional opening, you know, green grass environment where you get to fight Wispy Woods at the end. Yeah, I know you're amazed. So that kind of just introduces the kind of basic mechanics, many of which, obviously, if you've played a sort of orthodox Kirby game before, you're going to be very familiar with. But also, of course, you know, some of the friend, you know, the ally specific stuff, sort of bringing them over to your side using the hearts and all that kind of stuff. And then you got the second level, which is, you know, a cave, and then you go into a castle and fight DDD, the buff DDD that we've seen in the media for this game, go back to when it was first announced and stuff. So, yeah, you know, it gives you a bit of a flavour of it. I mean, in terms of the aesthetic, it is very much the Kirby, you know, aesthetic from, you know, the Wii and 3DS games, but you're more detailed. And you've got the kind of depth of field kind of thing going on, you know, that kind of slightly blurriness to the background to try and make it sort of seem more physical. But, you know, it is more detailed. The animations seem kind of more, you have more flourishes in there and everything. But it's, you know, aesthetically is very much the same style. Unlike, you know, for instance, on Wii U, you know, with the successor to Canvas Curse there, Rainbow Curse, that had the, you know, the claymation style and all that kind of thing, and which was, you know, sadly kind of
hard to appreciate on the gamepad screen.
I wouldn't say wasted by any means, but yeah, it was somewhat diminished in practice by the fact that, you know, the player was going to be having to direct his attention to the gamepad screen, which didn't really do it entirely justice. Whereas I suppose if somebody was just sort of watching along for playing as a Waddle Dee, I think was the two player in that scenario, then they could actually enjoy it. But it's not got sort of the artistic flourish sort of like that, but I've grown sort of fond of the traditional Kirby aesthetic, and this is definitely kind of the most lavish iteration of that you've seen yet. And of course it sounds great. The soundtrack seems like it's already well on its way to being another great entry into the Kirby pantheon of music. I think the most interesting part for me is going to be how multiplayer leveraged does it feel, because I might get to do a little bit of two player, but four player is definitely not happening, and probably not going to be playing everything in it to multiplayer, consider it if the scope is similar to the games like Robobot and Triple Deluxe. And then the other thing is going to be each game of the past three in the kind of traditional Kirby lineage has had its own kind of hook. You had the sort of ultra powers or whatever they were in the Wii game, where you took your traditional copy abilities and had the sort of screen filling, kind of versions of them. Then, when you got to Triple Deluxe, you had the sort of hyper suction thing that went on. And then with Robobot, I think they got it the most right with the having the mech and how that kind of that was the most versatile and most interesting kind of wrinkle that was brought to the traditional Kirby kind of level design paradigm, if you like, for me. Now, this with the friends, you see a few things. You see, like, okay, you've got the. You kind of turn into a little like wheel of friends, like a sort of and the crash through barriers.
A circle of friends. Thank you.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, obviously. And there's like a friend train at some point I've seen in the promotional video for some reason, and all this goes. It's leading heavily on that. I just wonder whether it will actually seem as robust in gameplay terms as the mech was, and actually kind of bring as much to the table versus kind of what you think of a standard Kirby level design.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed the demo. It's pretty short. It's probably, if you're excited for Kirby, it's probably worth making a European account for. I don't know if I'm 80 Canadian bucks excited for it, though. I guess we'll see. It's kind of rare also that we get a Kirby game so early in the system's life. I feel like it kind of feels wrong. And also
especially of this sort. You might get a canvas curse early, or something like that. But a straight up traditional Kirby game is pretty unusual.
Yeah,
and not that far off from Robobot either. So it's whether the sort of the appetite will be there for people who have been playing the 3DS game is going to be interesting to watch.
Well, as we announced on this show a few weeks ago, there will be another 3DS game this year, so there's a lot of appetite to fill, apparently.
Kirby's appetite is boundless, I suppose. We should, if there's any lesson to be drawn from all the games, it's that.
There you go. Look, we're all allowed to make bad puns here.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for new business. John will be joining us when we get back for listener mail. And we're going to, I'm not even going to try to make a commitment. We're going to do listener mail, and we will do however many we get through.
Nice.
So stay tuned for that. We're back for listener mail. You can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Before I kick us off, I'm just so used to just rolling right into the emails. John Lindemann is here.
I am. It's good to be here, James. I apologize for missing new business. I had some work responsibilities and then also some technical difficulties that conspired to prevent me from providing you with my new business, which really is not a whole lot anyways. So, nothing ventured, nothing gained, as they say.
Nothing gained, nothing lost. It sounds like might also be the situation here.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we can get through some extra emails this week, like, and not only solve one, because we want to solve your moral quandaries. We've ascended beyond gaming questions. You can send us your deep philosophical concerns, and we'll answer them on the show. Definitively, actually. Definitively answer them. John, would you care to present to us the first great question of our day?
Certainly. Ben from Australia writes, "G'day, RFN crew." It's very, very
stereotypical. It's actually written like that. John's not just doing
this. It's written like that. I mean, the stereotypes are real, guys. I recently finished playing through Mario Plus Rabbids and absolutely loved it.
Are you implying he wrote this with a knife? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Prime Minister.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote it after looking at your knife and saying, "No, this is a knife, James." So, I recently finished playing through Mario Plus Rabbids and absolutely loved it. The charm and care in the game is evident from start to finish, and the strategy involved in the gameplay was really refreshing for me, but very different from the games I normally play. Interestingly, the love I have for this game actually reminds me a lot of my experience playing through Pikmin 3. I had never played Pikmin previously, but I loved the look and charm of the game from the videos I had seen and decided to give it a try. I'm so glad I did, as it became one of my favorite games on Wii U. Now that I've finished Mario Plus Rabbids until the DK levels are released, and the release of the basically complete Pikmin 4 is nowhere in sight, I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for other games available on Switch that are similar to either Pikmin 3 or Mario Plus Rabbids. I realize these games are very different, but they are really the only games I've ever played in their respective genres. I know there is a seemingly endless amount of turn-based RPGs around, but do any of them have the combination of gameplay and charm that Mario Plus Rabbids offers that would be worth giving a try? Thanks for the help and the always entertaining podcast."
Woof. I'm trying to draw some kind of parallel between these games. It's not easy. I will say that Mario and Rabbids charm is kind of what makes it stand out, because otherwise it's largely a copy of an existing franchise.
Well, I wouldn't say a copy. I mean, it's not a... I don't think that XCOM invented the genre.
No, but it borrows heavily from the current form of XCOM.
I've read like an article by the developer of XCOM saying that Mario Plus Rabbids made him rethink a lot of things that he kind of defaulted to making XCOM. So, you know.
Sure, I was not going to come out there and go like, "Man, Mario Plus Rabbids fucking stole everything. What's going on?" But I get your point. But, I mean, its charm is kind of like what makes it unique in this genre, which is going to make answering this question kind of hard. Guillaume, you're our resident expert on Pikmin 4 and when it's going to come out.
Well, very soon. It's completed in some form, probably. No, I have no idea. I really don't know.
Is it possible Pikmin 4 didn't exist and they were just fucking with us?
Yeah, maybe.
Well, certainly. But also, it's very possible that it did exist and that it was put in a vault and it's going to come out with a 4DS. Like, who even knows at this point?
No, it's going to be the Switch Classic Mini, like 20 years from now.
Oh, okay. That's the unreleased game was Pikmin 4?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be the Wii U Classic Mini? Because it probably was a Wii U game to start with.
Still. I mean, the Wii U's life was... I
want to see the mini Wii U gamepad that comes with the Wii U Classic Mini.
Yeah, I look forward to the mini Virtual Boy as well, yeah.
It just takes one eye at a time. We're really trying to not answer this email, aren't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, if we're looking for turn-based strategy or RPGs that have the combination of gameplay and charm, like, if Ben has never played Advance Wars, definitely needs to go back to that and you know, get a copy for the GBA, because that's just like, you know, it's just bursting with personality.
And you've got Advance Wars 2, Black Hole Rising, and Advance Wars Dual Strike are all on Wii U Virtual Console.
Yeah.
Yep.
And which you would have access to on the basis of Pikmin 3. So there's that, and the Wargroove is coming to Switch, which
true.
Is more than a little influenced by Advance Wars by the look of it.
Yeah.
And it looks very high in the charm factor. It plays very differently. Whereas Pikmin is real time, this is not. Obviously Mario and Rabbids is not real time as well, but it's more of like a tactics game than it's that whole weird what is tactics, what is strategy, which is totally inappropriate for this question. So we're not gonna have that conversation now. But they are very charming, and there is something kind of fun and simple about them in the right way.
Right. Just don't think too hard about the fact that you're killing human beings in a war.
No, I think you should think really hard about it.
Fantasize about it even.
I mean, Guillaume, your new business basically said they're going to be replaced with machines anyway. So, I mean, just hurry it up. Let's go. It's just level in the field. I'm trying to think what would kind of be in the Pikmin space. The thing about Pikmin was it was so, like, weird mm-hmm. in and of itself. Like, it
Well, it's Little King's Story is the one thing that always comes to mind when you talk about
true.
Games like Pikmin.
If you can get a Wii copy of that, or it's on PC now as well. And it is very charming. It has a weird mix of city building and then kind of Pikmin-y style lead an army into battle, but with your avatar character. And a lot of times, just like Pikmin, where the bosses are kind of puzzles as well, like to figure out how to beat them. All of the enemies in Little King Story, at least all the bosses in Little King Story, are a puzzle of some description or another. And it's all set to jaunty classical music that they didn't have to pay anybody for. It was also released on PC if you have a PC.
Was there a Vita version at some point?
There was. There was a Vita version.
Sort of revised in some fashion.
Yeah, so that was that and I believe the PC version are essentially one and the same. But the Vita version was like a revision of some description. But if you're limiting yourself to the Switch territory, things do get a lot more difficult, obviously. Which you would not expect me to say it more difficult than the Wii U, but, you know, the Wii U had games for other systems available.
I don't know, with Little King Story, the Wii disc would work. So,
right.
You know, you kind of expand it out that way. You've got quite a bit there.
Yeah.
Anything on 3DS?
Oh, I mean, SteamWorld Heist is different, but again, it's kind of charming.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, clear sort of, you know, similarities with, you know, a Mario plus Rabbids sort of scenario, but, you know, played out in a kind of side-scrolling and aiming matters. You know, the characters and all that kind of the world building is a fairly significant, you know, component of it. It's not sort of cute like, the way that, you know, Pikmin might be, but, you know, it's not exactly. Because I think the reason why these sorts of games are not the most commonly thought of is when you're thinking about warfare of some sort, it tends to get kind of depersonalized because, you know, killing things on a mass scale is not very nice, you know, so it's you might be, you know, sort of faceless machines fighting bugs or, you know, like that kind of thing. A lot of the time it's pretty charmless, so, you know, these sort of scenarios are where you've got some real character to, I guess, you know, shooting up robots is okay in the SteamWorld.
And they even kind of blow up in a semi-charming way. But in terms, if we're talking Switch, yeah, Wargroove.
Well, SteamWorld Heist on Switch now. So
it is,
yeah. That,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're talking Wargroove, SteamWorld Heist, and of course Mario and Rabbids has had a ton of DLC come out, so you could always go back to the well if you want to. Assuming you haven't bought it all.
Well, it sounds like I could have done by the time, you know, until the DK stuff comes.
Yeah.
I think he's ready for the Big Ape.
For the Big Ape. Can you love the Big Ape?
Well, yeah, they obviously have had some DLC, but it's very much, you know, in a similar model to what we've seen with Zelda and Xenoblade 2, you know, where it's like, okay, here's a pack, but there's a kind of larger, you know, more substantial part two, you know, kind of thing coming sometime later, you know, with the kind of new story type content in it. And we haven't got to that point yet with Mario and Rabbit.
So it's coming out in that particular DLC is apparently coming out in the spring. So yeah, I think we're kind of tapped out.
Yeah, it's funny because I was checking out online if Chroma Squad was coming to the Switch, and there doesn't seem to be any news. Chroma Squad was a tactical RPG, turn-based, with pixel art, and it's kind of based on the Sentai shows, you know, like Power Rangers. And it does seem to fit the bill of, you know, tactical RPG gameplay and just a lot of charm. But instead of finding news of a port, I found a website that uses an AI to generate lists of games that are like whatever you're searching.
Nice.
Yeah. So the first, the top ranked recommendation is Mario Rabbids, Kingdom Battle, of course. And then Steam World Heist. And then we get the Wii U, Fire Emblem GBA on the Wii U. But then Disgaea 5, but that's another thing, you know.
Yeah, this guy is all about just the grind.
After SteamWorld Heist, maybe give Worms a try, because that is kind of somewhat turn-based, and it's got a lot of personality, and it is kind of tactical, but it's a 2D plane. And
Is there a good Worms game lately?
Well, this one is called Worms WMD. It's on Switch, and I haven't heard bad things about it.
Okay.
The thing is, like, those games are so interchangeable. Like, who even knows? Mm-hmm. Like, what difference there is between one version and the next?
Oh, there are well, the bad Worms
you see,
games.
Now you're gonna get a diehard Worms fan writing it.
Yeah, we're gonna get an email, Guillaume, and I'm gonna make you read
but
it.
I mean, you know, when you're paying attention, sure. When you're not, then like after the fact, trying to compare like a list of features or whatever between two Worms games, like you're gonna have a tough time distinguishing between the two.
It's like me with Kirby games, for example. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, because all the Kirby games are basically exactly the same.
It's just a pink dude eating stuff. That's it.
What? No!
Pig dude eating stuff, yeah. Well, no, he pretty much got it. I mean, we talked about how Kirby is insatiable. Mm-hmm. So. Darkest Dungeon comes up twice in this generated list.
That's not really charming. That's more.
No. What the heck is Worshippers? Yeah, okay. It's giving me games that are not on Switch.
Yeah, we're now in the I'm Googling to give you an answer phase of this email. So.
I'm so sorry. Yeah. Mercenary Saga.
Hey, if you have a recommendation if you have a recommendation for Ben, go ahead and let us know in the email, or you can post it over at NintendoWorldReport.com's comment section, and Ben, you can check it out there. Or if we find if something else comes up, we might give it a mention up on the show if it's like, oh, we should have thought of that. Or we'll just take credit for it, which we might also do. So, on that, Guillaume, would you care to read the next email?
Would I?
That's why I asked.
Bryant writes, "Hey guys, I was just wondering if you could talk about your usage habits for Switch. I'm paranoid about the lithium-ion battery, so I find myself not using the Switch the way I want to. For example, if I take out the Switch out of the dock, I find myself using the battery down almost all the way before putting it back in the dock. Are you guys like me, or do you just dock and charge the thing or play it in portable mode whenever you please?" Well, yeah, I'm not super concerned about the battery because unlike on an iPhone, it can be used or replaced, right? I can just order a new one and replace it, and problem solved.
Can it be?
The gamepad, the Wii gamepad, I definitely did that, and the 3DS.
Yeah, I've done that with the 3DS.
Yeah, it would be a kind of a dick move if they remove that now.
So Nintendo will replace it for a price. Looking at the teardown instructions to get to the battery right now, it doesn't look that complicated. You will need some decent tools, but not like expensive tools, but like you're gonna need a Nintendo uses weird screws. You just need to be aware that Nintendo uses weird screws. They always do, and I'm sure they're weirdo screws this time as well. But yeah, it looks like getting to the battery isn't super difficult. But of course you void your warranty when you do that. Mm-hmm. But there's no access panel to get to it.
Yeah, now to his usage, you know, it's interesting, since I got Rocket League, Rocket League is kind of a game that I play before I hit the sack, you know, so I have the Switch sitting there on the nightstand, and I just kind of left it there. And normally I don't do that, but I find I play my Switch a lot more portably. Just I like having it just kind of like laying around the house so I can just pick it up and play, sit down, start playing. So I would say now I use it more portably than anything. And I think I probably always have, like traveling or whatever. But now even around the house, I use it more portably than I do in the dock.
Yeah. And so I just got through the instructions. You basically, if you take the bezel off, which is four screws, you pop the cord. You be very careful taking the cord off. And then you're in. The battery's right there on top. You swap the battery out. You put the cord back on. You're good to go.
I guess it is different from the Switch gamepad situation where they actually sell you a new battery on the Nintendo store.
A higher capacity battery.
The higher,
But also, like, that battery, I think, came with the screwdriver I needed.
It did, yeah.
But whereas Nintendo is apparently offering a service to do it, but I don't know how much that's going to be because they haven't done it yet. So I am aware of the concern, but it's never something I've really spent a lot of mental stress on for any device. And, you know, maybe I should, but it's not usually a problem for me in general. I just kind of deal with it. So eventually my Switch will not charge as much as it used to because I basically just leave it in the dock at all times, unless I need to go play with it portably. And so I've been playing a lot of Dragon Quest Builders portably. You know, I was like up in my office playing it. But generally speaking, I would say I'm about 75-25 on TV. And if I'm not using it, unless I'm upstairs, I put it back in the dock. And so I know you're not supposed to leave it charged in. I would assume they've done something on their side to try to minimize it. As we've become more comfortable with lithium ion batteries, companies have developed technology to try to minimize the drain, although it's still there. I mean, it's chemistry. Is it physics or is it chemistry? I guess it's both. It still happens, but batteries have been developed that are less susceptible to it. Procedures have been developed to try to minimize it. I would assume Nintendo was very aware that by building a thing that sits in a dock, they need to be at least semi-cognizant of it.
But, yeah, and I mean the whole marketing, the whole point that they made the Switch the way it is so that you can take it in and out of the dock whenever you want, you know, when you have to leave the TV. So I don't know. I wouldn't stress myself out too much over that. The only thing is that before I received my screen protector, I was kind of paranoid about, you know, taking in and out of the dock because I had read stories of people scuffing their screen because it's made of plastic. Scuffing the screen, just using the dock the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, so, I guess the suspicion was that because the dock is plastic, you know, fairly sort of flexible, that maybe some docks have been like pinched slightly in, so the opening wasn't kind of quite the right size anymore, and that's why it would scuff the screen,
something right. Like that, yeah, or that the rubber pads on it were just slightly or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, like on mine there are scuff marks right there, like on the, like where the pegs are, like on the, I mean, I have the screen protector, but there's visible marks on there. It's not scratches so much as you can tell there's wear there.
Yeah, that's kind of annoying. Like, I don't have a 3DS model that doesn't, you know, eventually, that didn't eventually got scratches on the screen because of the way that the bottom screen has the bezel raised. And anyway, it just ends up imprinting itself on the top screen, whatever I do. So, yeah, like, I don't know. Like, maybe Nintendo's engineers should be a little bit more careful about that kind of stuff. Yeah, the whole battery thing never really crossed my mind. But I've got good news for Bryant, though. If you ever kind of ruin your Joy-Con batteries, Nintendo is selling AA battery chargers that you can install on your Joy-Cons. So use those however you want, and you're always going to be able to replace the batteries.
Yeah, for me, usage-wise, I've spoken about it plenty. Or, you know, as this, you know, this is the anniversary Switch, just about. You know, well, it will have passed by the time this episode's published, you know, because it's the 3rd of March. You know, over that year, it's been maybe 85% portable. You know, it's a big majority portable for me. So I haven't been paranoid about kind of, you know, my usage, the way I use it, kind of affecting the battery so much. Although, you know, clearly, you know, with that kind of domination of portable, you know, I mean, it is going to be an issue, as you said, James, one day. But you know, for me, I do at least kind of do stuff to try and sort of sustain the battery if I know I'm going to kind of not be putting it back in the dock for a long time. So, you know, turning down the brightness if I can, you know, if the lighting conditions are such that I don't really need it that bright, putting it in the airplane mode just to shut off the Wi-Fi, just to give, you know, a little bit more juice, you know, get it to last longer. I mean, obviously it varies by game, doesn't it? You know, depends how demanding what you're playing it is in terms of how quickly the battery's going to run out. But, you know, I will try and just, you know, modulate things every now and again. You know, it's not just like, I mean, with 3DS and stuff, for instance, so it's much more like, oh, just leave it on, you know, pretty much the highest brightness or something like that. Leave the 3D on. You know, I very rarely kind of modulated things to sustain, even though the battery life wasn't fantastic on that, you know, especially like the first model. But, you know, with this, when you are playing a more, you know, power hungry game like a Zelda, you know, and it's, you're talking about, you know, 2.5 hours or something like that, like, just I do still do those little things, even though, you know, was it buying me probably a few minutes or something? But, you know, but it's not really a matter of, you know, thinking about the health of the device over the sort of medium term or anything. It's just a, you know, a practical thing for that play session.
Yeah, I've never really... I actually kind of wish that, I mean, the Switch doesn't even tell you how long you've been playing games. I kind of wish it gave you some intel on this. I'd be curious what games I play. Like, I can't think of it in my head. Like, what is it? What do I do when I have it out? Because you know, I've been playing Fear Effect a lot this week, but I haven't played it almost at all out of the dock, except for the purposes of being able to kind of give impressions of that on the review, if necessary. But Xenoblade 2 was played out of the dock mostly in protest, because that was a disaster. But I bet I played a ton of Odyssey out of the dock, and I don't know why, but I'm just trying to do this from my head.
Really depends on the game sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of experience you want with it, and whether it's a game that, if it's a game where I'm going to sit down and play it for a long time at a stretch, I might do it in dock. But if it's like something like Rocket League, like I said, it's, that's a pick up and play game, so it's great to just have it lying around so I can, you know, play it, play a match or two, and then just put it down, go to just do something else.
Yeah, I bet when Atelier comes out, I'm gonna be spending a lot of time outside the dock on that with the TV on, because it's, I'm gonna go craft things for 2 hours.
Yeah, exactly. If it's something with a lot of grinding, Yeah, that you don't necessarily have to really be right zoned in on. Yeah, for right. sure.
Yeah, when I was scrapping in Xenoblade 2, it was basketball on TV and like 40 minutes of Rex diving in and going and tell me about all the cool things he pulled up. Mm-hmm. Oh. But in terms of the battery stuff, just in case we haven't actually explained it, the lithium-ion batteries are susceptible to charge, decharge, and losing their full charge capacity. There are guides on the internet. I'm not going to recount them here on how to maximize the lifespan of those batteries. I can't say, as I don't know, and I don't know if there's any information about it, like how much the battery will decrease based on that specific configuration. But I mean, it is a reality of life in cell phones and laptops and now home consoles / portables. The future is a nightmare, John.
It is, and we're all living it right now.
We are in the future. You are listening
specifically on this podcast. We're all
you are listening
this
to us talk in the future.
Mm-hmm. Right now, the battery
is your past.
The battery in the device to which you are listening this podcast on is dying. It's dying a slow death, but a death nonetheless.
That's right. It was more alive when we said this than when you heard it.
Yep. See that right there? That's that life going away.
Just like Guillaume's right now as we ramble on. All right, let's. I'm gonna read the next email. MASB writes, "Hail RFN balloonists. Why did I give myself the MASB email? God damn it! All right, I recently felt a tingle in the force. Upon investigating it, I found, to my surprise and delight, that a fine group of linguists and computer scientists had taken it upon themselves to translate the DS game Tingle's Balloon Trip of Love." Into English. A cursory look at screenshots of the game tells me that amidst filling in your girl diary, Tingle must contend with soulless shoes, fake Famicom games, life in the hereafter, and what's underneath the veil. All while trying to become famous. Really pertinent and existential stuff.
They really stole the story of Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
See, I was thinking this is more like The Great Gatsby, so I mean, which is basically just Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, so that's fine. Mm. Are there any other fan translated games that you would like to play, but haven't yet?
I like the way that sort of assumes that we definitely do want to play that Tingle game. It's,
you know, I mean, I don't want to play it, I guess.
I'm insulted that MASB is implying that I haven't, that I'm not on top of all the fan translated games.
I assumed you wrote it, to be honest. I assumed you wrote the translation.
Well, actually, with the first paragraph of the email, like a group of linguists and computer scientists, I thought he was talking about us. I was like, I don't recall translating Balloon Trip of Love.
We drugged you, by the way. Mm. So you did do that, but we just...
Is that like getting Mr. T on the plane in the A-Team?
There you go. I've totally lost the plot on this email. Okay. Are there any other fan translated games that you would like to play but haven't yet? Are you bad enough dudes to circle your... God damn it, I should have just stopped when I had the chance. Are you bad enough dudes to circle your man beams around this delightful title for a future retroactive? Your friend in the 9-to-5 protein factory grind.
I must confess, I've never patched fan translation into any kind of ROM. I know you guys all have played Mother 3, but I still haven't listened to that.
I didn't really get to do that very much, unfortunately. No? I didn't really participate much in that retroactive because I didn't really have a good way to put the time in, because it was, you know, I mean, it's not the longest RPG in the world, but. It's somewhat significant, so yeah, that would still be something for me, you know, to have a more convenient way to play a translated version of that game, because it's, you know, it's very well thought of in a lot of sectors that aren't James, and
because people who aren't it is very well James thought sector. Of in sectors people who aren't right, yes.
And I played Earthbound and I enjoyed it, but with some caveats. Like I did use some kind of sort of tricks with the virtual console. You had sort of like cutting out, trekking to a boss every time I tried to fight it. You know, and things like that with the save states and whatnot. But in general, the nature of the game didn't put me off in the way that it put some people off. So I think Mother 3 would be fine with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I keep hearing about fan translations, but it's never something that I've ever had any time to sink into. Just kind of finding the translation, patching the ROM, finding the ROM. Just finding a way to play the ROM, and it's so much easier to just boot up anything else instead.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, it would have to be something I was absolutely desperate to play, you know, somehow, and usually that's not kind of an issue, you know, especially because for me, you know, the games that I probably have coveted the most over the years and all that tend to be more action-y and stuff, you know, they don't really hinge on the text.
As opposed to RPGs or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. I mean, so it usually falls more into the kind of curiosity kind of sector. I mean, I do have a copy of Captain Rainbow, which I've not played because it was going dirt cheap. And there has been a fan translation project with that. And I know it was their goal to do a Fatal Frame 4 style sort of patch, you know, where if you had a soft modded Wii, you could actually, you know, sort of use a game disc and then, you know, kind of patch in the English text and play it, you know, as if it had been localized. But, you know, so it's kind of because it was so cheap, I kind of thought, well, you know, either that will happen or I could sort of bungle my way through it one day and still have some fun with it. I haven't touched it yet. But so, yeah, that would be one if that ever happened. I don't know what the plausibility of that is, you know, as we get further and further away from that game and its very brief period of relevance.
So I've done a few of these, and I've talked about them on the show. So Tales of Innocence, Gyakuten Kenji 2, a.k.a. Ace Attorney Investigations 2, Bahamut Lagoon. I've done others. I did the original Tales of Phantasia before it came out on the GBA. So it was originally a Super Famicom game. It never came out here. And then eventually there was a GBA release that I bought and played for a little bit and said, I've already played this game. There's a handful on the DS that I really want to play. Somabringer, first and foremost. From Monolith. It is fully translated. Yasunori Mitsuda at Takashi and Saga all worked on this game. I would like to play it. I just haven't. Tales of the Tempest, which is the other Tales game on DS. I'd like to at least see it. I don't know that I want to play it all the way through. I don't know that it's considered to be a very good one. Yeah. I don't know if Tales of Hearts, the other Tales game on DS, got translated or not, but that eventually did get a release in the West, I believe, in another format, so that's fine. Game Center CX2. I have the translation. I have the cartridge. I have the ROM that I've dumped from my own cartridge. But I haven't actually done it. Like, all I have.
I bungle my way through that, which is challenging. You probably lose in a fair bit there. And, you know, obviously there's an RPG constituent game and, you know, all that, like Cardia Quest and all.
Yeah,
that.
I played a little bit of it. You know, no, I did put them together and I played a little bit of it. I tried bungling my way through, and yeah, when you got to the Cardia Quest mandatory sections, I was like, this is obnoxious.
And also there's a sort of a Famicom Detective Club,
yes,
style, you know, adventure game, you know, with your Sakamoto worked on those games back in the day. He's in that sort of style again. That is very much like, yeah, it just sucks any entertainment out of that. I mean, the Guardia Quest you could still, you know, enjoy the way you would enjoy if you was importing an RPG. You know, you can appreciate some things, you can't really appreciate others. With the adventure game, it's like, no, this is just, you know, a question of pressing the right menu things until it's over. You know, so the translation would have been nice.
Yeah. And then there is some Sega CD games that just never came out here because the Sega CD died. And so, like, the Police Knots one is a pretty good one. Because there's, like, this is the best version of this weird disc-based game. And I don't know if Police Knots is a good example, but there's a bunch where it's like, oh, yeah, the Sega CD version is the best one of that, or the whatever is the best version of that, but that one didn't come out, so you're just going to have to live with it. That I would like to try to get my hands on and play. Well, Police Knots in particular, I'm kind of fascinated by. Just conceptually more than actually like, man, I bet this will be fun to play. Mostly, this would be curious to play is probably the better way of putting it.
Yeah, that's usually how I feel about these sorts of things. And that's generally why kind of, in the end, the kind of amount of readily available stuff just kind of... And it kind of trumps the curiosity, just the fact that things that are accessible that you can play out there, not quite kind of curious enough to kind of motivate me to get past the, admittedly not particularly big hurdles these days if you're really interested, but they're big enough when you've got plenty of other things to play.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, it would be probably dumping a physical copy of a game that showed up at my door quite a few months ago. I don't know who sent it to me, but it's a game called Kokoro Scan. James?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I never mentioned this to you,
didn't it?
But I do have. It is Ansei Kanju Soku Teiki Kokoro Scan.
Yeah, you could tell if we're lying to you on the show.
Yeah. So I got that game. So there you go.
You sure did. I'd forgotten I'd even mailed that.
Yes, yes.
I got Kokoro Scan. I'm like, who the fuck sent Sean Kokoro Scan?
Who else would send me Kokoro Scan?
What kind of fucking
better question. Right. And I think, it was funny because that actually arrived and there was no return address on it. So
damn right there was.
So I knew right away. I'm like, this is. And I open it up. I'm like, okay, I know who sent this.
John just opened it and said, James Jones has the upper hand.
Yes, yes. So,
well, because I couldn't lie, because now you have Kokoro Scan,
yeah.
And so you'll be able to tell that I'm lying.
To our audience, this is part and parcel of being on this podcast. Every once in a while, you get a really fucked up game that shows up on your doorstep.
Well, I mean, I talked about the fact that Johnny sent me a bunch of Japanese GameCube games, and he had texted me about it, but then they showed up like 3 weeks later, and I totally forgot. And I'm like, what the fuck is all this?
I mean, James, like, you sent me BMX Triple X, right?
No, I handed that to you.
Yeah, oh, right, in Colorado, right? Yeah.
We played in
some
person.
Things are better done in person.
Yeah.
I bought that for a PAX you bailed out of, and then I had to hold it for 2 years.
Yes, I bet you did. I should have mailed that to, like, Guillaume or something. I should have just paid it forward. I gave it away, so I don't have it.
The ring at that point.
Yes,
you gave it away to what, a trash can?
I gave it away to the Goodwill, so... There's probably some homeless guy out there who is playing BMX Triple X and loving it. So that's
John, that's not how Goodwill works, for one. Two,
yeah.
What the fuck gives BMX Triple X to Goodwill?
Yeah. paying it forward. Paying it forward. So,
God damn it.
I wonder if it's still there. I should go check. You know someone's picked it up. Buy it back.
But yeah, more in line with what Greg was saying about there's just so many things readily available to play instead. The perfect example of that is one game that has a fan translation that I am kind of interested in playing is Seventh Dragon on the DS.
Yeah.
And, it's a game that was made by the creator of Etrian Odyssey. And I've played the third... Actually, it's not even the third game. There's third.
You play VFD. It's the third game.
VFD 3 or something.
It's code 3
VFD. It's like 3 the fourth
VFD.
Game in the series. Yeah.
Yeah, whatever.
Anyway, so it's convoluted. But that game, unfortunately, kind of spoils, I'm sure, what is a big twist in the original. So not that the point of playing the original would be to experience the twist, but, it's kind of diminished because of that. But also, it's by the creator of Etrian Odyssey. It has a lot of similarities, probably, with Etrian Odyssey. Sega, who put out Seventh Dragon, now owns Atlus, who's been cranking out the Etrian Odysseys. There's so many similar experiences that keep coming out all the time.
Yeah.
Can you imagine trying to get away from your creation only to find that your new company bought them?
Yeah. No, yeah! That's kind of funny. Yeah, I kind of wonder if at some point Sega is going to start asking Atlus to remake the original Seventh Dragon and, you know, maybe rope in the guy who created it. Like, I don't know.
I thought I escaped, but they brought me back in.
Yeah.
There's actually a couple. These are a little bit more more esoteric games. There's a couple Satellaview games that came out that I kind of want to try my hand at.
Oh, Radical Dreamers is an interesting one, isn't it? Because that's definitely got a fan translation. The sort of sequel to Chrono Trigger. It's a kind of follow-up to Chrono Trigger. It's essentially proto Chrono Cross, like a rough draft of Chrono Cross as a kind of visual novel-y thing.
So
that has been fan translated, so that kind of exists. It's out there. I'm kind of curious about it, but considering I have Chrono Cross and have never really played it, I may get it sort of to Guillaume's point again. I should probably be doing that before I start hunting down fan translated Radical Dreamers.
Oh, I don't know why you think that's necessary. Because it's a text adventure. You'll be fine. But there's a weird game that came out called the English translation was something like The Story of the Town Whose Name Was Stolen. That's this goofy Satellaview thing. But then there's a bunch of Zelda Satellaview games that came out, including ones that aren't actually a Zelda game but just kind of use the engine, that I would like to have tried. Because keep in mind, Satellaview were also like limited events and...
Broadcast. It was actually, yeah. It was the BS in the notes, it's a broadcast satellite, So, yeah, there were Zelda games where there was somebody, like, speaking as part of a broadcast, it was kind of a live event, as it were.
Yeah, it's bizarre to think about. But then, of course, we've talked about it on the show a couple times, there's Eiji Aonuma's first game. Treasure Island.
Yes, that's right.
But to Guillaume's point, even though I've kind of gone like, you can find the time, there is a limit of time. Time does have a limit. We will not live forever.
Yeah, death is right behind us at all times.
I mean, not for John, apparently.
Not. It's actually right ahead of me.
Oh, did death pass you?
Yes. I'm hurtling towards it quicker than ever.
John's undertaking death right now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Flipping it off.
Yep. Wow, this is kind of a dark episode.
Oh, they're all dark if you think about it long enough.
Yeah.
Well, in the sense that they took time, and time that, the opportunity cost of that time of our lives, of our listeners' lives, yeah, they're all pretty dark from that point of view.
We could have been playing fan translated games in all this time we spend doing the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
All right. Greg, would you care to read the last email?
Sure. Ben writes, greetings from the frozen tundra that is the UK this week. Well, yeah, that's I suppose that's also practically true for me to be saying that as well. It is very cold. You touched on this last week, but what is the deal with Bandai Namco? These rumours of involvement with Metroid come when Nintendo and Namco Bandai are very close friends. But why? Working on Smash will have helped get Metroid, if that is the case. But what makes Namco Bandai attractive to Nintendo in the first place? This even questions if Switch Smash is also a Namco Bandai project, which is likely. I doubt they were swayed when they learned they could get the sweet, sweet exclusive that is Lost Reavers. What do they get from this that hiring a new dev studio can't bring? Does Hirada make Kimishima weak at the knees? Who else outside Nintendo could work on Prime? Platinum? Nipponichi Software America? Or could they cheat and get Armature to do it? Getting ready to hunt some bounty.
There you go. John is the world's foremost expert on Lost Reavers.
Oh, God.
Why was that game made? It was just so mediocre. Like, it's, I don't know what makes it worse, the fact that it wasn't absolutely terrible, or just the fact that it is utterly mediocre.
Yeah, like, there is a point of like, man, what if this game was just terrible? Like, would that be better?
I guess you've got Devil's Third to answer that question, right?
Yeah,
we do. And
to answer, you know, in terms of like things they did with Japanese developers exclusivity in the Wii U era, that they had that base covered is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
that's true. Oh, you're right. So Nintendo has had before the merger, when it was Bandai and Namco, Nintendo had a pretty long running relationship with both parties. They have been, for lack of a better phrase, in there for a while, and post merger that didn't really change. Nintendo owned a bunch of Bandai stock and what was rumored of an attempt to acquire that company. And to this day, they in fact still own a bunch of stock in the combined company. They own like 1.5% of Bandai Namco, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it makes them one of the largest individual holders of the company. But mostly it's this Japanese thing about how relationships matter a lot in business, like a whole lot. And the same thing goes on with Tecmo Koei and Nintendo.
They've got a lot of Japanese, you know, the big Japanese developers. Of course, you know, Capcom, you know, they made Zelda games with them, flagship, you know, before they ended up incorporating, you know, a lot of those developers actually into, you know, Nintendo's own teams. But, you know, like that, they've worked with a lot. Obviously, there's been kind of ups and downs, particularly we think of Square in that category. You know, but like, I mean, even with Bandai, like obviously at one point Bandai was making the Wonder Swan, which was, you know, kind of a competitor to the Game Boy. I mean, admittedly, it was never really gonna, you know, topple it or anything. I don't think they probably envisioned that doing that, but you know, they got Gunpei Yokoi, the guy who made the Game Boy after he departed Nintendo. They made a separate, you know, a rival portable device, and it tried to, you know, go along with the sort of same principles that had made the Game Boy a success when it came out, in terms of, you know, it was kind of cheap and very, you know, good on battery life and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, there's not been always, you know, there's been a certain kind of adversarial component to it, and I guess that probably cut off like some of the cavalcade of Bandai licensed stuff from Nintendo portables for like a brief period.
Yeah, I mean, and of course you had the era where Namco was champions of gaming Nintendo's system to try to get more games out.
Yeah, wasn't there some story, I don't remember all the details, but wasn't there something about a Nintendo executive having dinner with a Namco executive that fell asleep?
I don't know. Amazing.
They were incredibly offended. I don't know where I read that. Whether it's Chris Kohler's, one of Chris Kohler's books or Stephen Kent's books. But yeah, there's a story where I think it was Namco where, you know, they had some business thing, and, you know, it was just the three CEOs sitting there, and the Namco CEO fell asleep.
Oh, man.
And offended, I think it was a Nintendo person, so much that was it. But this is the kind of stuff that happens, you know, in Japan. It's very much, like James said, it's very much it's an old boys network, but almost like kind of like a, you know, very political, like, I personally don't like the CEO of this company, so I'm not going to work with them ever.
Oh, I mean, and Nintendo's now two executives ago was notorious for this. Mm-hmm. Like, personal slights are the business.
Yeah.
So actually I did a little bit digging on this one, and this came up around the time Namco was announced to be doing the development for Smash. And Kazuhiro Harada, who is, I mean, he is as close to the face of the company as Namco Bandai has. Like, you know, he's their big personality. Like, he's a name that people know from their development staff. He was basically asked why Namco Bandai was picked for it, although he wasn't involved in that. And he said, well, basically his answer was, well, we have a long history of fighting games, he figured Nintendo recognized. But he also says they have, quote, continually developed a very good relationship not necessarily in the public spotlight, but kind of behind the scenes, we have a very good working relationship with them. Not just with the company, but we have a good relation with Sakurai and Sora as well, which was funny because Sakurai was basically Sora. and so we were in a very good position to make a game like the Smash Brothers series. So basically he's saying, not only do we have a good relationship with Nintendo, we had a good relationship with the people that comprise Nintendo and its affiliated corporations. And also they had the experience and therefore they were in position to get the deal. Nintendo didn't have the staff to make it themselves, and so they went to the people they know.
And I mean, that also happened with Smash, with Brawl as well, didn't it? I mean, that had a lot of, was it Game Arts or, you know, like they had to, you know, they had to go outside to get the bandwidth in that case as well. So yeah, there's a damn good chance they'll be going outside for a, you know, and if you know, if it were to get an original Smash game or a port, or you know, you could bet your life they'll be doing a similar thing, and you know, Namco Bandai would probably be, you know, the prime candidate in that area. I mean, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? You kind of touched on it with the quote there. You know, is that, well, they had this pedigree with fighting games, and maybe feel like it, you know, certainly it was a more natural match than Game Arts back with Brawl, to be honest. But you know, some people are kind of maybe thinking like, well, what's their expertise in making something like Metroid? Or, you know, it seems odd in that respect. But, you know, to be fair to Nintendo, for all the sort of relationships that they have with you know, some of the biggest publishers in Japan, you think of little developers in, you know, smaller developers, I should say, you know, in the West, people like Next Level, or, you know, like Left Field and all that, like they've ended up kind of, you know, if they do a project with them and clearly they establish a working relationship, they keep going back to them, don't they, you know?
Yeah.
The Monster Games, for instance. So, you know, they will, you know, kind of, once they've got that relationship there, you know, they keep, you know, I'm sure they get, you know, pitched on stuff by the developer, or sometimes they go to the developer and say, what do you think about this? And it kind of opens up from there. So, you know, you think of Next Level Games, you know, you've gone from, you know, Mario Strikers to Luigi's Mansion to, you know, Federation Force. You know, there's no kind of obvious through line there. In terms of, oh yeah, well, you know, this kind of, they know how to make this kind of game, so, you know, like I mean, clearly the main thing there is just that they, you know, when Nintendo makes a game in this fashion, yes, they're maybe, you know, kind of putting a lot of, you know, some of this sort of bandwidth that they don't have internally onto external developers, but, you know, they are very much still creating the game. You know, they're working very closely with the outside developers, they're overseeing it, there's, you know, very detailed communication going back and forth. So, you know, it's not as if it's kind of like, oh well, you know, what a Namco, you know about you know, making a Metroid game. Well, you know, Nintendo, I mean, admittedly, you know, Retro, you know, aren't making it or whatever, but there's still people at Nintendo, presumably with the oversight of the kind of the prime series producer, you know, in particular, like they have the knowledge, you know, and it's a question of kind of imparting it to the outside developer.
And it's not like, I know, so well, but Nintendo didn't make it either, but guess who owns Retro Studios? Like, you better believe that if Nintendo NCL doesn't know how to feel about something that is going on with Metroid Prime 4, they've probably sent it off to Austin to say, hey, you guys take a look at this and tell me what you think.
Yeah, kind of a consultant kind of capacity, if nothing else. I mean,
yeah.
But yeah, you know, I mean, there's plenty of people, you know, on the Japanese side that also worked on those games.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, even though, like you said, in that case, a little bit different because you're talking about a wholly owned studio rather
right.
than, you know, something that is an external entity. But I'm sure there's certain aspects of the process that are kind of similar in both cases, you know. So, you know, I feel, look, I mean, the reporting is pretty
you know, clear, I feel like, here to conclude that it's clear enough to conclude that, you know, they are working on the game, but to what extent, you know, they're working right. on it, or, you know, all this kind of stuff, you know, how much is being handled internally, could there be other, you know, kind of external developers involved? I mean, some of these kind of really big, ambitious games now, I mean, you can end up with a lot of sort of groups, fingers in the pie. I mean, just look at the credits for Breath of the Wild, you will see a lot of different kind of companies get name checked.
Oh yeah, and
yeah, because the scope of that game obviously is just enormous. I wouldn't imagine a Metro Prime 4 being quite that big, but you know, it could be fairly ambitious.
Nintendo does a surprising amount of their work in-house relative to what other big publishers do these days, because of the size of these games, which, you know, it's part of their conservatism. That they don't, you know, they don't outsource a lot of stuff. Now it does help them with leaks, I guess. But I mean, it's kind of that's not really the whole reason you run your company a certain way. It's mostly just conservatism. Like they want to know who they're working with. I mean, quite clearly, they want to have a good relationship with who they're working with. They let one company, Grezzo, make three fucking Zelda-esque games on the 3DS and go completely off the reservation on their third one.
No. Once they kind of, if somebody kind of gets their foot in the door, they seem quite happy, you know, and it goes well then they'll keep going back there, and it won't just be like, okay, this like very utilitarian, like, you know how to make game X, so we will use you for that kind of game. Like, it will go beyond that. It won't just, you know, I mean, like you said, you know, Grezzo very much in that, you know, the all those games were technically kind of similar, you know, and you could point to some others where, you know, like when they have Camelot make sports games or whatever. But, you know, the next level example, you know, I think you could see it's more about the working relationship that they feel they can have, rather than just like, oh, okay, these people know how to make a certain kind of thing, so
yeah,
just,
I mean,
use them for that.
I would point out that Nintendo doesn't own HAL. Like, HAL is just there. Like, that's just the relationship they've got. I want to say they're invested, but I don't think they're the sole owners. And certainly the situation is not different than Goodfeel, who Nintendo definitely doesn't own. Like, it's just I think part of it is they developed a close relationship, and the other part is it's a consistent income for the companies that work with them. You know, it takes having that. I mean, for lack of a better word, having that patron, keeps you insulated from the volatility of developing video games. And so,
yeah, that you got to think that's got to be a big upside for a developer, you know, that's looking at, and you've got to be worried about, you know, when you're going to be in demand, or you know, whatever is going to happen with the market, that if you've got that kind of stream of income that you feel like you can rely on more, that's it's got to be a huge kind of relief for everybody concerned.
And to bring it back to Namco Bandai real quickly, when Nintendo bought Monolith Soft from Namco Bandai, that was precipitated because apparently the Monolith Soft team was starting to chafe inside the Namco hierarchy. There had been an executive changeover, and they felt like their creative freedom was being reined in. Nintendo basically bought 80% of the company, and Namco kept a percentage on the deal that they would continue to get to leverage them for some stuff, which they have. Namco's, what are those games? Those crossover games.
Project Crosszone.
Yeah, are developed by Monolith, but they're published by Namco, or Namco Bandai. And I guess that's part of the deal. But whereas Nintendo saw the opportunity to add development staff, which they're a really lean company.
And also, you kind of feel like that was a case of, I think, they're maybe identifying maybe an area that they felt they internally were not as strong in, that Monolith, you know, could bring expertise, you know, to them that they didn't currently have.
The Namco Bandai executive staff explicitly sold this deal as, oh, this is going to help us forge a closer relationship with Nintendo. Which is a weird thing to say, because it's like, well, it's a company that you're going to share ownership of, I guess. That's true. Like, this was right after they had released two exclusive GameCube games. Like, what do you mean a closer relationship? I mean, this is obviously something that both sides have groomed. and continue to groom to this day. And Namco Bandai has a ton of development capacity. Nintendo, as I said, is a lean company. Whereas a lot of major publishers have a dozen studios around the world, Nintendo doesn't necessarily have that. And so having these external partnerships with people they trust allows them to make more games at the same time and hopefully keep their pipeline free to develop new concepts for games and then turn over the mechanics of developing them to people outside of the company so they can go on and keep making new ideas. And getting through that really important first couple phases of idea, prototype, and then refinement until you have something you want to build the game around.
No, and I think Nintendo's generally got a pretty good track record with this sort of thing, even if the developer, you know, is not someone you would immediately associate with the kind of game they end up, you know, helping to make. I mean, some people might point to examples like, you know, Other M is not that well thought of. You know, Star Fox Zero is not that well thought of. But, you know, for me, first of all, I don't dislike those games. But also, I would say, if I'm looking at the flaws in those games, I don't think it's on the external teams, really.
Those both came out of Kyoto, the flaws of those games.
The Platinum and Team Ninja, that is not on the, you know, that's not the part of those games that kind of held them back. I mean, I think it's more
they were following specs. Like,
yeah, right. Exactly.
They delivered the game they were asked to make.
Yeah, I don't really feel like you could say that was the component of where it kind of fell down, you know. So again, you know, I kind of feel like Nintendo's pretty damn good at communicating, you know, what it wants done to external developers and working with them to get it to happen. Now, whether that is something that, you know, you could say the same, I think, with Federation Force as well, you know, but whether it's something that fans ultimately want is another matter. But I wouldn't say that it's like, oh, well, you know, it's an external developer and they didn't really know what they were doing and they didn't have adequate, like, guidance. I was like, no, I mean, I rarely think of that really being an issue with some of these kinds of projects that Nintendo's done over the years. So I'm not particularly concerned about that with Prime 4.
I mean, I will tell you right now, Tecmo Koei, or Koei Tecmo, I can never remember the order. It's Koei Tecmo.
Well, with Bandai Namco, it's changed around, hasn't it? Like, since the merger, they've the official order has changed.
I think they've both changed it. I want to say in Koei Tecmo, Tecmo Koei's case, it was, like, different depending on what region you were in for a little while.
Yeah, well, I guess that makes it the forwards-backwards thing with Japan, yeah. I mean, but yeah, anyway.
It's like, it's just fucking unbelievable. I guarantee you right now, Koei Tecmo, somewhere inside that company is either making or is currently working out the contract deals to make a game with a Nintendo license. Besides,
oh, yes.
Besides one we know about. Someone in that company right now, and it's the middle of the day there, is looking over like paperwork related to a Nintendo game they're making. Because that relationship is tight. And it will happen again. And that person probably works at Omega Force. But it is what it is. So you can look forward to Pikmin Warriors in 2019.
Well, you got the Fatal Frame.
Which is also Pikmin 4.
The Fatal Frame thing. I mean, you know, Nintendo bought that property. You know, obviously it's not been leveraged that much in terms of, you know, well, they didn't localize Fatal Frame for, you know, they kind of partially localized it, you know, came to Europe, the Fatal Frame 2 remake.
Right.
Both of those were kind of, you know, well, the Fatal Frame 2 remake was really rather late on Wii. Then, of course, you had Maiden of Blackwater on Wii U, which was digital only, and it was on Wii U. So, yeah, you know, I don't know. You can imagine they're going to want to give another run to that property at some point.
Well, and you think about why did Nintendo buy, of all properties, Fatal Frame? And
well,
you
see what they've done with touting Resident Evil kind of exclusivity on GameCube and all that. I've always thought it seems like a bit of a self-conscious thing, you know, because of the kiddie image or whatever. That's like, oh no, you know, like, we'll prove how not kiddie we are because we've got horror stuff, you know. Like,
see, I look at that one as they bought the game, but basically are going to continue to let Tecmo Koei make them. I always looked at that as more really just the contract on which they signed that they're going to continue to be partners. Like, that was just the physical thing that represented the partnership more than
sort of a software form of binding. You know,
yeah, like it's like this is the thing that, like, we had to sell something in order to make this have a physical manifestation.
The,
so
the
I don't know.
Ring.
Yeah, so I don't know. Fatal Frame, whatever. Because Nintendo certainly didn't in-house Fatal Frame development. It's just now it's on Nintendo platforms forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just basically, to sum it all up, they're friends.
Yeah, I do actually. I did find the source of the falling asleep story.
Oh, I would love to end the show on this. So please.
All right. So this one is actually this goes back to 1988 with the beef between Nintendo and Tengen.
Oh. God.
Yes. So the. December 1988. This is actually from Insider. I got to give them props for this. It's a good article. This is on. This article is from when Minoru Arakawa left Nintendo. So this was in 2003.
That was Yamauchi's son-in-law.
Right. Yes,
you know, it was at this time the president of Nintendo.
Correct. So this all started with let's see, it is I'm just trying to get the name. Nakajima is the Tengen executive. Hideyuki Nakajima is the Tengen executive, where this all happens. So this is a kind of this, you know, these two companies, you know, Nintendo and Tengen, they eventually kind of were at war with each other because the origin of the fiasco, however, would begin with a standard licensing contract. Infuriated by the fact that Arakawa would not budge on his contract to allow anybody else to make games, to create more than five games a year, that's where this started. So Tengen wanted to make more than five games a year. Nintendo would not allow it at this time.
They couldn't be bothered to have like Ultra Tengen, like Konami had.
Exactly.
Ultra Games.
Yeah. This is where Ultra Games came from. Konami wanted to get around it, so they created a new company. Right. So
Tengen's was even more screwed up because they had to deal with the Atari garbage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're part of Atari Games at this point.
Well, they're part of one of the Atari companies. I don't remember which one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
God.
So Minoru Arakawa refused this. Tengen was pissed. Part of Atari Games, storm home, fuming, he declared war on Nintendo. Nakajima's company proceeded to crack Nintendo's security chips system that was implemented in all of its NES games. This ultimately allowed Atari Games and Tengen to create their own NES software without giving Nintendo a cut of the profit. So at that point, to try to make amends, Minoru Arakawa, he had a party. And he invited Nakajima to it just to try to, you know, make amends and try to, like, iron things out. Because he kind of understood where Nakajima was coming from. You know, these restrictions and everything. He didn't like it. But Minoru Arakawa, he had a talent of falling asleep at the oddest times in the oddest places.
And nice.
He just happened to fall asleep. While he was at a meal with Nakajima. And, of course, this made things even worse. And Nakajima was even more pissed with Nintendo after that because this offended his honor. And he thought that it was so offensive that Minoru Arakawa would fall asleep while having a meal with him and sitting down.
Keep in mind, this was all happening in the U.S. because Tengen's an American company.
Yep.
And Arakawa was working at NOA.
Yeah.
And the restrictions was an American. Yeah,
this was all happening in the U.S. with this incredibly Japanese bullshit.
Yep. And this followed up. There was a lawsuit from Atari Games, and you know, they alleged that price fixing was going on and all this kind of stuff. So yeah. So all of this stuff. So very, very. So you know, if you're dealing with Japanese executives, don't fall asleep when you're eating dinner with them.
The Tengen story is amazing because they basically lied to the United States Copyright Office to get a copy of the NES lockout chip, mm-hmm. which also got them in all kinds of fun legal trouble. Oh my God!
Yeah,
the '80s were nuts.
Yep, so that's good stuff, Minoru Arakawa.
Remember, if you can marry into the family of a major corporation CEO. You should definitely do that. A family-run corporation at that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying. You could be a narcoleptic at work, and it's okay. You'll still be made president of a division. And on that life advice, it's time for us to end the show. You can send your emails to rfn at nintendoworldreport.com. Greg, do we have any WiiWare recommendations this week?
Not one that I'm going to read just now, but yeah, the clock is ticking. We recorded this on March 2nd. Oh, sorry, yeah, March 2nd with me.
It will be for me in about 5 minutes.
Yeah,
so.
But by the time this goes out, we'll be, just 3 weeks away, basically. So it's going to have to be quick, but yeah, we'll certainly get round to reading some more recommendations before that deadline hits us. But for now, music-wise, it is, as I mentioned before, the first anniversary of the Switch, the anniversary of the Switch. It's been a year, March 3rd, last year. It's gone by pretty quickly, I'd say, with all that portable play to pass the time, and I think most people's memories of the Switch launch are probably bound up in Zelda. I don't want to discount Bomberman and 1-2 Switch, but chances are Zelda is what most people remember. And even though, yeah, we did the spoiler cast and used a great deal of music in that, this game has a pretty massive soundtrack, despite its reputation for having kind of a sparse sound design, and music involvement in that. I've picked out this battle theme. This is Dark Beast Ganon Phase 1, which really kind of does a fun job of bringing together a number of kind of motifs from the soundtrack. This is excellent. Really, really great kind of a little microcosm of the whole thing. So I thought it was really suitable to sort of cap off the first year and remember where it started.
Nice. You know, when I think of the Switch launch, since I was playing Zelda on the Wii U, I really think of 1-2 Switch. So instead of, I'm going to rebel and you're going to hear the baby from 1-2 Switch for a few minutes after this.
But you'll be owning that. So it's essentially, it's like people will go like, God damn, that game's weird.
Hmm.
And I mean, if you want to do that, I'm not going to stop you because I can't. But I'm just going to say, I will change the credits at the end of the episode. All right. Well, on that, it is time to end the show. As we've already talked about, your now 1-year-old Switch is slowly dying. Just like we're slowly dying.
Exactly. Yeah, so, please.
Bye, everybody.
Remind us all of our mortality. Bye.
Later. Maybe.
Oh, God.
Yeah.